On Saturday afternoon in Texas, former Navy SEAL and author Chris Kyle was at a gun range doing something he had done often, trying to help a serviceman who suffered from PTSD. Kyle, who was also known as the most deadly sniper in American history, faced countless dangers during his four tours in Iraq. So it came as a shock when we found out that the man he was trying to help on Saturday turned his gun on Chris Kyle and his friend and shot them both to death. We spoke with Chris Kyle a year ago about his career and life after the military. Let's listen to some of that interview now. Well, we're here talking about you as a highly efficient killer, Chris. Is that to be applauded or condemned?
No, I did what I had to do to save American lives. And in the book, I did not want the number in there. But the publishers definitely wanted it, helped sell books. But I would like to be known for the number of saves I had, but you just can't calculate that.
What's the difference between a kill and a save?
Well, I'm talking about the only time I ever killed anyone was when they were actively trying to bring violence to my guys or allies or the innocent civilians. And those people that were able to come home because of me doing my job, that's what I'd love to be known for.
How many people did you save?
I cannot calculate that.
When you pulled the trigger all those times, Chris, was there any hesitancy on your part, any doubt?
Definitely. I mean, I wasn't out there purposely trying to kill people. You know, it's definitely difficult to take another man's life. So the only way to justify it to me was either I kill this person or I sit there and watch my guys die.
You have said you wish in some ways you had killed more.
Definitely. And that's referring back to watching the young Marines and soldiers and even my brothers being carried out on stretchers. I failed them. I did not do my job. So, yes, I wish I could have gotten those guys so they could have come home.
Tell us how you sized up potential targets, Chris. What's the process there?
We're just sitting there. You're watching. Most of the time I had to watch an area looking for any kind of criminal activity. That doesn't mean I'm allowed to shoot just because it's criminal activity, but that just means that you're going to draw my attention to towards you. Once I start watching you, then I'm looking if you're within my rules of engagement to where are you actively trying to kill Americans or the local Iraqis around that area? And then if you are, then you have to show me clear intent. And then that's when I can act.
Like what kinds of activities, what kinds of actions would make you suspicious and help you train in on a single individual?
It's a wide range. Anything from placing an IED in the side of the road to kidnapping. You know, I overwatched a couple times where they were trying to kidnap children of Iraqi politicians, actively shooting at our military or trying to, you know, they were trying to execute civilians to deter them from coming out and voting.
And when you're watching these people, you're watching them through what, the scope of your rifle?
Yes, sir.
What's that like? You're seeing a very finite, limited area then, right? Very focused.
Well, my scope has a variable enlargement in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can zoom in, zoom out, but while I'm watching, it's zoomed all the way out of the magnification. That's the word I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But zoomed all the way out so I can get the broad view because I'm still trying to take in, you know, I have to learn the culture before I go. So I have to watch this wide area and find anything that might be out of the ordinary, abnormal. And then from there, then I can start to zoom in on that specific area and try to figure out exactly what's going on. But at the same time, I have both eyes open, so I can still see more, a little broader view of what's happening, because if I do take a shot, I don't want someone else running into my crosshair without me knowing it.
Hmm. How do you separate innocence from enemies?
You have to be within my rules of engagement. You have to be actively trying to kill an American or one of the innocent people living there.
So you have to see a weapon or a grenade or an IED. You've got to see something that allows you to open fire.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What's the toughest part, Chris? Is it pulling the trigger, or is it getting into position to begin with?
Well, depends on the area you're in. Sometimes it's definitely extremely difficult to get in, and some of these hostile environments where, you know, no Americans were wanted or allowed in. But then, it's always difficult to pull the trigger on someone. You just have to keep it in your mind. The only reason you're doing this is to save people.
And just so our listeners understand, a lot of times you would move ahead of a company of Marines. You would move ahead so you could get into position to offer them protection and make sure as they moved into a town, for instance, they would have a clear go at it and wouldn't run into people shooting at them or grenades. Your job was to sort of clear the way and make sure the path was all ready for them, right?
Right. I'm just trying to catch people ahead of them, setting up on them. I'm not going to take everybody out. They're still going to come in and face a force or an enemy activity. I'm just trying to soften it up to where it's a little more manageable for these guys. Not really that I'm going to make a huge difference, but if I see something that's just blatant, people setting out these bombs ahead of them, I'm also the eyes and ears out there so I can relay the intel back to them. You know, the biggest part of a sniper is not, you know, just shooting the gun. It's relaying intel back to the guys.
So would you sneak into you want to be in a tall building, I imagine, in most cases. Would you pick out a place and sneak in early in the morning before folks were up and about?
That's what we try to do. I mean, but it's not always a building. You're just trying to find the best terrain to give you the best view of the whichever area you're trying to watch.
Chris, you tell a pretty riveting story about your first sniper kill. It was in a tiny Iraqi town in March 2003. Can you describe that one for us? It begins your book, actually.
Yes, sir. It was during the initial invasion into Iraq. The Marines were, you know, on their march to Baghdad or race to Baghdad, and we were trying to stay out in front of them to try to help out, but you know, the guys were going so fast, we were having to bump 2-3 cities out in front of them. Just so happens this city that we were in place as they were coming into the city, the local townspeople were coming out to, you know, show their support that they weren't going to fight so the Marines could come on through. I saw a woman out there who had pulled a grenade out and pulled the pin on it. And she was walking towards the Marines as if she was one of them greeting them. I relayed this information to my chief. He told me, that's a Chinese grenade. You need to take her out. So I definitely hesitated, and I asked him to get a hold of the Marines. So we tried radioing the Marines because I would prefer they make that decision instead of me. But then we could not raise them on the radio. So chief kept hollering at me, you have to take the shot. You have to do it. And it's definitely hard. This was the first time I ever had to pull the trigger on anyone. Didn't know if I could kill a man. And then, worst of all, it wasn't even a man. It was a woman. So it's definitely an experience that has stuck in my mind forever.
What went through your mind that day after you pulled the trigger?
I was very angry with her for putting me in that position to have to do that. I felt like, you know, I either sat here, did nothing, watched her walk up to the Marines and they all die, and then I definitely wouldn't be able to live with myself, or I have to shoot her. And I was angry with her for putting me in that position.
You didn't feel guilty?
No, sir.
Because?
I was saving Marines.
Do you think about these things? I mean, I guess what people will wonder, Chris, you know, when you go to bed at night, do these moments cross your mind, race through your mind as you're lying there? Or is this really something that's part of your past now?
Well, definitely the things that crossed my mind are the guys that I had to witness being carried out, or the guys who died next to me or in my arms.
I was interested in the fact that you don't even consider yourself the best SEAL, much less the best sniper. Why not?
I almost failed out of sniper school, and I know I was not the best.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, sir. And I'm not the best shot, especially, you know, among the SEALs. There were other SEAL snipers that were better than me. Just so happened I was in the place, and I had more targets come up to me than the other guys did. And I always tell everyone that Carlos Hathcock, in my mind, is the greatest sniper ever. He has less kills, but having more kills doesn't make you a better sniper.
What can he do that you can't, Chris?
Well, he went in by himself with a lot less, you know, lower value technology than I had. His weapon systems weren't as good. His optics weren't as good. He didn't have the concealment abilities that we have now. And he would stalk in for days just to get one enemy and then stalk back out. And that's everything about a sniper. Whereas I went in with the team and I would take my shot and then I had to stay there and my team had to become my security and we were in a defensive position. Whereas he was out there on his own.
You know, some of your shots, and this really struck me, were from a distance of even more than a mile. And for those of us not familiar with rifles and new technology, how do you shoot someone a mile away with enough force to take them down?
Well, I was using a bigger caliber rifle that day. I was using a .338 Lapua. And with the optics that we have, I can definitely zoom in way out there farther. I can see farther than my gun can shoot. So the optics definitely outdo the weapon system, but we have to do that so we can positively ID something wrong. And then it's just, you know, I definitely have a ballistic computer with me, or at least a printout that I have Velcroed on the side of my rifle that tells me, you know, if they're at this distance, turn the knobs for the elevation to come up this many clicks or this many minutes. And then all I have to do then, for the most part on my half, is just, okay, what's the wind doing? And try to figure all that out.
So at that distance, the wind can be a factor?
Oh, yes, sir. The wind's a factor at almost any distance.
Hmm. And so if you're shooting at a distance of a mile or a mile and a quarter and the wind is blowing, how much can the wind push a bullet one direction or the other? Talking a few inches?
Oh, no, sir. You're talking feet.
No kidding.
I mean, especially out, you know, your margin of error at 100 yards is usually around 1 inch. So at 1,000 yards, it's 10 inches. And then now you're just going to push that out to 2,000 or 2,100. That's 20, 21 inches just alone for what the rifle can do. And now you're figuring in what is the wind going to do.
Mm-hmm. If you shoot from that distance and you miss, does the target even know that he has been shot at in some cases?
He will hear the round go overhead if you hit anywhere around him. Or if, you know, you shoot low, he may never know. Or if you shoot way high, he may never know.
I'm wondering about support when you got home, Chris, and you left the SEALs. Is it what it needs to be for former members of the military? What's been your experience?
Well, early on, no, it was not. I mean, early on, especially, they were sending us directly from the battlefield straight home. And that is hard to comprehend. But now they're starting to do layovers. You know, they're flying us to different locations to have a decompression time for a week or 2 weeks where there are therapists there that they force you to talk to them because they don't want to just hear you say, no, I don't have a problem. They want to make sure you don't have one. And this is also time to blow off your steam and you're not surrounded by your family to where you feel like, okay, now I have to be this other person. And then when you do get home, they do these follow-ups with you and make sure that you're doing okay.
And is it enough, Chris?
Well, I mean, is it ever enough? I don't really know. I mean, we train people to go and do a job, and then when it's time that they decide they're getting out, there's no real training on, okay, let's train you this other way now. They kind of tell you what civilian life is expected now, but they don't really train you how to become a civilian.
You write in this book, as your wife does, about the challenges that all of this presented for your marriage. You were deployed 4 times to Iraq. How tough was it for the two of you to get through these years of military service?
It was definitely tough. I mean, it's a 95% divorce rate in the SEAL teams, and it was the constant being gone. My last 3 years of service, I was home 6 months, because even when you're not deployed, you're still on your training cycle, and most of your training is done out of state, all over the country. So you're never at home, and it's just that absence that really hurts you. But even then, when you do come home, because you've been gone for so long, my wife, she had her own routine that she was doing. She knew what the kids wanted. I didn't even really know the kids. So when I came in, it caused another problem because now I'm trying to be in charge, and it's throwing a wrench in it.
But you survived it.
Oh, yes, sir, we did. I definitely married a strong woman, and she stuck with me through it all. And she finally told me, look, enough's enough. I can't keep doing this. So I hung it up, and I am thankful for it every day because I have a great relationship with my kids that I love and adore, and my wife.
Tell us a little more about what you're doing these days, Chris.
Doing a Kraft International, which is a military and law enforcement training company. Mm-hmm. This way I still feel like I'm giving back. I do feel the police are going to be the first responders for anything here on our home soil, so I want to help them with anything that I may be able to give them, and the same thing with the military. I am trying to help them out to, you know, I'm not going to solve everything, but maybe I can give them a tool for in their toolbox that may come in handy down the road somewhere.
Chris Kyle was 38. He was killed on Saturday at a gun range in Glen Rose, Texas.